This is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. Thanks for joining us. On today's program, I'll be reading news items from various publications, including a piece from ABC News describing the reaction of parents and experts to RFK Jr.'s comments about autism. I'll be reading an article from the New York Times entitled, "When Natural Disasters Hit, People with Disabilities Feel Them First and Worst." Also a piece from the Sports Business Journal entitled, "Nets Become Fourth Team to Deploy One-Court Haptics Device," along with several other topical articles, beginning with this piece from ABC 15 entitled, "Governor Katie Hobbs Vows to Veto Bills Until Lawmakers Pass Fix for Disability Services." Arizona's Division of Developmental Disabilities runs out of money at the end of April, by Manuelita Beck, published April 17, 2025. Phoenix. Arizona Governor Katie Hobbs announced Thursday she will veto all bills until lawmakers send her bipartisan legislation to fix the massive $122 million budget shortfall for the state's disability services. Hobbs, a Democrat, vowed to veto any bill not already on her desk until there is a serious bipartisan funding solution to the Division of Developmental Disabilities budget hole. The Appropriations Committees in the House and Senate advanced on Tuesday a Republican-sponsored bill to fix the shortfall. The proposal, which Hobbs has called a non-starter, includes several reforms to DDD, including a major cut to the Parents as Paid Caregivers program. This is a move to put pressure on her legislature to get something to her desk that she can actually sign, said Brandy Kuhn, the founder of Raising Voices Coalition, an advocacy group for caregivers and Arizonans with disabilities. The House was scheduled to vote on 35 bills Thursday, but cut business short after only an hour, having voted on 7. Democrats voted no on all 7 pieces of legislation in solidarity with the DDD community, Minority Leader Oscar De Los Santos said on the floor as lawmakers wrapped up business. "Right now, we are doing everything humanly possible to make sure that we deliver for people with disabilities, and that includes this strategy of voting no that we did today on every single bill," he told ABC 15 afterward. State Representative David Livingston, who as chair of the House Appropriations Committee leads budget talks, said Democrats are playing political games. And the governor childishly came out today and said, "I'm not signing any more bills because she's not getting her way," he said on the House floor. Too bad. The Senate did not have any votes scheduled Thursday, but one Democrat in that chamber told ABC 15 the caucus there also would have voted no on any legislation. De Los Santos said his caucus is open to negotiating, noting that every Democrat on the House Appropriations panel supported a bipartisan proposal put forth by a Republican lawmaker on Tuesday. "I want to plead for humanity here," he said. "I want to beg my Republican colleagues to come to the table and negotiate." That bipartisan amendment to the DDD funding bill narrowly failed in the House panel after Livingston added 3 additional Republican members minutes before the hearing began. Several House Republicans declined interviews Thursday, but several slammed Democrats' refusal to vote in remarks on the House floor. "We need to be better than this," State Representative Nick Cupper said. "And the way I see it right now, if we're voting on one bill because of an unrelated bill, we're failing our people." Meanwhile, Senate President pro tempore T.J. Shope said senators are working on their own solution. "We're going to get this resolved," he told ABC 15. "People are going to move on. We're going to have some reforms that will happen. But we're going to have a very level head about this. Republicans have narrow majorities in both the Arizona House and Senate. Budget leaders in the House have pledged to fix the shortfall before DDD runs out of money at the end of the month, but only with reforms aimed at preventing future money woes. He promised this will get done, and it's time for him to deliver on that promise, Coons said of Livingston, and I'm here willing to work with him to collaborate on what will work for our community and will best serve our legislators at the same time. Hobbs has called for lawmakers to pass a clean supplemental bill that just funds the $122 million shortfall. A Democrat bill to do so was blocked last month in the legislature. The governor also has said she is open to negotiating later for changes to DDD. She said in a statement Thursday that she wants Republican lawmakers to end the political theater and pass a bipartisan supplemental funding bill to protect services for Arizonans with disabilities. It is shameful that Representatives Livingston, Gress, and other members of the legislative majority continue to hold Arizonans with disabilities hostage to their manufactured chaos, Hobbs wrote, while they leverage a crisis of their own creation to engage in political warfare, Arizonans with autism, Down syndrome, cerebral palsy, and other disabilities are the ones harmed by their partisan attacks. That's unacceptable to me. And after meeting with families dependent on these critical services, I know it's unacceptable to the nearly 60,000 Arizonans who rely on the Division of Developmental Disabilities to live their lives with independence and dignity. Their introduced proposal is unserious and a complete non-starter. Republicans have said Hobbs is to blame for the shortfall, while Democrats have said the legislature has had plenty of time to pass a funding bill. DDD runs out of money at the end of April. If lawmakers do not pass a supplemental funding bill, the agency would shut down until the state's new budget year begins in July. Coons said the stakes are high for the nearly 60,000 Arizonans with disabilities who receive DDD services. Without this funding, we could unhouse very disabled individuals, she warned. We could cause the caregivers that they struggle to get day in, day out to actually show up at their home to quit their job and go work for a fast food restaurant. Next up is a piece from the BBC entitled, I Was Told I Shouldn't Be a Mum Because I'm Blind. This was published April 17, 2025. Jen Troth has always wanted to be a mum, but a medical professional telling her she should not have children because of her sight loss has made the prospect terrifying. The 29-year-old social media influencer, who lives in Cardiff, has the hereditary condition retinitis pigmentosa and only has about 10% of her sight left. She said there needed to be better awareness that disabled people exist in public life. Meanwhile, other women with sight loss have said their children had become confident and caring people as a result of their experiences. The Welsh government said it provided funding to help people with sight loss live confidently and safely. Ms. Troth said she experienced generational trauma due to her father and grandmother having the same condition. Her dad, Peter, 74, was basically told he was unemployable as a mechanic when he began to lose his sight, forcing him to move to Dubai to start his own business. Because of this, I was raised not to talk about my blindness, and I didn't tell anyone until I was 24, she said. I was afraid to tell employers, to tell friends. She said safety considerations faced by many women were heightened by sight loss, particularly regarding relationships. Ms. Troth added, you just have to trust that people in your life are going to be good people when, in a lot of cases, they're probably not. I had a previous partner lock me in a room once to try and scare the blindness out of me and prove I wasn't blind. She said these issues extended to medical professionals, and she was consistently told by an eye care consultant that she should not have children. "I've always wanted to be a mom. I'm very family-oriented," she said, adding she was now less afraid of going totally blind than being a mother. She said she worried about coping as a mother, particularly as her partner, who was an engineer, often worked away. "It's honestly terrifying," Ms. Troth said. "I've not got any peripheral vision. How am I going to see a child running around? How am I going to be allowed to look after a baby by myself? How do I access support? You're also constantly thinking, if I don't have a child soon, will I ever get to see what my child would look like?" There are about 2.2 million people living with sight loss across the UK, and 60% are women. Until the 1960s, these women were often considered unfit to parent, and some went through sterilization. But the Royal National Institute of Blind People, RNIB, said many disabled women continued to fight for respect and support today. About 41% of blind and partially sighted women felt there were misconceptions about mothers with sight loss, and 26% believed these were held by health professionals, its research found. Ms. Troth uses social media to raise awareness, visiting hospitality venues, and showing what they are like for someone with access needs. Rhianne Morris from Bridgend has nystagmus, myopia, and glaucoma, and has lived with visual impairments since she was born. Two of her sons, aged 13 and 3, have sight loss, while her one-year-old has Down syndrome. "Stuff like changing nappies, I probably take a bit longer with. Buttons and poppers on baby clothes, I've lost hope with. I buy ones with zippers now," Ms. Morris said. She said taking her son to school could be challenging because of people parking on pavements, but she had a symbol on her pram telling people she had sight loss. The 39-year-old said her phone was her lifeline as it allowed her to take photos of things and then zoom in, adding, "I have taken the boys away on my own and done days out on my own because I want the boys to know they can do it. If you can't do something, you will find a way around it or you will ask for help." She believed sometimes people, often well-intentioned, underestimate her abilities. But women with sight loss shouldn't be afraid to become mums. "Anyone has to adapt to having children. It's no different," she added. Tafsila Khan, a mum of three from Cardiff, who also has retinitis pigmentosa, said her sight deterioration was gradual until her early 30s, after she had her children, none of whom inherited the condition. The 40-year-old added that from a young age, her children could look out for the correct bus, order at a cafe, or ask a retail worker for help. She said, "Taking them to the park and things I thought would be a challenge, but they've grown up with a mum with sight loss, so for them, that's just the norm. It has made them so much more confident. They've had to do things other children didn't, but I feel it's had a positive effect." Ainsley Workman, director of RNIB, said negative opinion toward people with sight loss and assumptions about their ability to parent could have a huge impact on their confidence and access to resources. "Becoming a parent can bring new and unexpected challenges, regardless of who you are. This doesn't stop parenting from being a hugely rewarding and exciting experience," she said. RNIB is calling for everyone to support mothers with sight loss by making information accessible and dispelling harmful myths. The Welsh government said the Wales Low Vision Service provided by Optometry Practices was the only service of its kind in the UK and provided more than 8,000 appointments for people with sight loss, of which almost 5,500 were women in 2023-24. "We fund a number of organizations to help people with sight loss live confidently and safely and work with the Wales Vision Forum to improve access to services," it added. And now an article from NPR entitled Families say school civil rights investigations have stalled after federal cuts. Published April 16, 2025, by Dylan Piers McCoy. There are a lot of things 12-year-old G likes about school. She likes gym class. She likes to help other students. She likes to craft with her teacher. But when you ask what she doesn't like, G doesn't hesitate. "The blue room," she says, sitting in her home outside Fort Wayne, Indiana. That's a padded room G's family says school staff sometimes lock her in. It feels like close spaces, and it's like scary in there. Her mother, Amy Cupp, says G has disabilities, and because of them, she sometimes has tantrums at school, lying on the floor, refusing to follow instructions, and trying to leave the room. Sometimes when this happens, school staff seclude her. Cupp keeps track of every time educators put G in a room alone, based on reports and emails from the school. So far this year, she's counted more than a dozen incidents, according to a lawsuit Cupp recently joined. "As soon as they go to lock the doors, she freaks out," Cupp says. "It's beyond sickening." G has fetal alcohol syndrome, autism, ADHD, and a mild intellectual disability. Cupp and her husband adopted G as a toddler, and Cupp asked that NPR use only G's first initial because this story describes the symptoms of G's disabilities and her school's response. Cupp says that after weeks of trying to get G's school to change the way it handled her daughter's behavior, she filed a complaint with the U.S. Education Department's Office of Civil Rights, or OCR, which investigates discrimination in schools. The office recently lost more than 40% of its staff after the Trump administration launched a massive downsizing of the department. Now, Cupp and other parents say their civil rights complaints aren't being investigated. Last week, Cupp joined a lawsuit that aims to force the federal government to act on complaints like hers. The lawsuit claims the layoffs have undermined OCR's ability to fulfill its statutory and regulatory mandate to enforce civil rights laws in schools. "I just can't fathom that anybody would cut something so vital," says Cupp, a devout Christian. She says she voted for President Trump and thought he shared her beliefs. "But I can't understand why they're doing what they're doing, because that is not what God would intend." The White House referred NPR's request for comment to the Education Department. In a statement, the department said, "The Office of Civil Rights is working vigorously to protect all Americans, and especially our most vulnerable, from unlawful discrimination." It said OCR has been actively processing disability discrimination complaints for weeks and pointed to a recently opened investigation into DC public schools. The department's committed staff will continue to prioritize the educational needs of those with disabilities, the statement continued. Why OCR investigations are different. OCR attorneys review all kinds of allegations of discrimination in schools based on race, sex, disability, and more. In the short time Trump has been back in office, OCR has pursued high-profile investigations into universities it accuses of using race-exclusionary practices, and into Maine's policy allowing transgender women and girls to compete on women's and girls' sports teams. But the majority of the complaints OCR receives have historically been about disability discrimination. "The loss of a functioning OCR is a huge hit to the disability rights community," says Rachel Pereira, a fellow at the Brookings Institution. OCR lost at least 240 staffers in the recent cuts, and it closed 7 of its 12 regional offices, including the Chicago branch that handled Indiana cases. Even before the cuts, OCR was overwhelmed with a growing number of complaints, with investigations sometimes lasting months. Pereira says the Trump administration's changes will likely exacerbate those delays and undermine civil rights protections. Children get one shot in education, right? You don't get to do fourth grade over. And so if it takes a year or two for a state government or federal government to intervene, then you have serious missed education opportunities and a lot to make up for, Pereira says. Parents of children with disabilities have some options if they believe their children are not receiving the education they are entitled to under federal law. But special education advocates say nothing quite compares to an OCR investigation. OCR can examine whether there is a larger pattern of discrimination at a particular school or district, while states often focus on whether schools are meeting the needs of individual students with disabilities. And unlike lawsuits, families can file OCR complaints without legal assistance. But some people question whether the Education Department should even be handling civil rights complaints. Jonathan Butcher is a fellow with the Heritage Foundation who helped shape the education sections of the conservative policy playbook Project 2025. He says the federal government should protect the rights of students with disabilities. But OCR's backlog, among other problems, has been getting in the way of that. He believes civil rights investigations would be better handled by the U.S. Justice Department. We should be interested in making sure this is done effectively. It wasn't done well before, so now we're looking for a way to do it better, Butcher says. The Trump administration hasn't yet pursued such a move, but it has made other education policy changes laid out in Project 2025. Change is difficult, and that's why it doesn't happen very often at the federal level. But this is an opportunity to streamline federal processes, Butcher says. Nowhere else to turn for help. For Amy Cupp, filing a federal complaint with OCR was a last resort. She says she had tried suggesting other ways the schools could handle her daughter's behavior, and she sought help from special education advocates outside her district. At one point, Indiana's Department of Child Services investigated whether G had been abused at school. A report the agency issued later says the state could not substantiate the allegations of abuse, but the document, which Cupp shared with NPR, describes bruising under G's arm and says it is believed the bruising came from being restrained at school. The bruising allegations were also included in the lawsuit Cupp joined. I felt lost, Cupp said. I just could not believe there was nothing I could do. Part of the challenge is that restraint and seclusion are common, if controversial, practices in schools. Over 100,000 U.S. public school students were secluded or restrained during the 2017-2018 school year, according to federal data. Most of those students had disabilities. In the past, the U.S. Education Department has pushed schools to limit the use of restraint and seclusion. Federal guidance published in 2012 says physical restraint or seclusion should not be used except in situations where the child's behavior poses imminent danger of serious physical harm to self or others. In 2016, OCR said that in some circumstances, restraining and secluding students with disabilities could be a violation of federal civil rights law. By Amy Cupp's count, G's school has secluded her 14 times and restrained her 15 times this academic year, according to the lawsuit she joined. Cupp shared records with NPR documenting some of those incidents, but the district did not report all of them as seclusion and restraint. G's district, Norwell Community Schools, told NPR in a statement that it implements reasonable and appropriate safety procedures on school property in order to maintain safety for all students, faculty, and staff. Cupp, a licensed social worker, understands that schools use restraint and seclusion in crisis, but she believes her daughter has been subjected to those practices at times when she does not pose a risk. Spending less time at school to avoid seclusion and restraint. When Kupp filed an OCR complaint late last year, she says she felt like she had finally found help. OCR investigations can lead to agreements that require schools to change how they educate children. Earlier this year, an OCR attorney told Kupp the office planned to open an investigation into her school district. But the attorney looking into Kupp's case was laid off in March as part of the education department's downsizing. Kupp says she hasn't received any updates since. The education department told NPR, while it is currently processing disability discrimination cases, it could not confirm the status of individual complaints. As she waits for the federal government to step in, Kupp says she has cut the amount of time G spends at school to just 2 hours a day. She hopes that if G is there less, she'll be secluded and restrained less. And now from the Disability Scoop, Hulu releasing Rosie O'Donnell documentary on service dogs by Sean Heasley, published April 22, 2025. Rosie O'Donnell is bringing attention to the transformative role that service dogs can play for young people with disabilities in a new documentary. The film, Unleashing Hope, The Power of Service Dogs for Children with Autism, spotlights how a service dog named Kuma improved the lives of O'Donnell and her child Clay, who has autism. "I didn't have any idea that they had service dogs for autistic kids," O'Donnell says in a trailer for the documentary special. "Kuma went right to Clay when they met," she said, adding, "That's her person." In addition to Clay, the documentary features the family of a child named Caleb, 9, who has autism and who is taking the first steps toward receiving a service dog. It also pulls the curtain back on how the animals are trained. O'Donnell said she first learned about the Guide Dogs of America service dog program through her friend Lyle Menendez, who is incarcerated. The film explores how the organization has turned to prisoners to help train service dogs in order to meet demand for them. This groundbreaking initiative not only prepares dogs to change lives, but also transforms the inmates themselves, instilling purpose, empathy, and hope with a 0% reoffending rate among participants, according to those behind the documentary. Unleashing Hope will be available on Hulu starting Tuesday. Next, we have this piece from the Sports Business Journal. It's entitled, "Nets Become Fourth Team to Deploy One-Court Haptics Device" by Ethan Joyce, published April 17, 2025. The Nets have become the fourth NBA team to deploy one-court haptic devices for fans with blindness and low vision, joining the Trailblazers, Kings, and Suns. The device combines haptics and audio so that fans can follow live action via game data feeds, bringing the game to a community that has long been underserved in the sports industry. 5 one-court devices will be available for free at the Barclays Center, with fans able to pick them up at guest services on a first-come, first-served basis. Ticketmaster has provided the sponsorship element for all 4 NBA deployments this season. The Nets pilot tested one-court devices for multiple games at the end of the 2024-25 regular season, working with NYC-based Visions Services for the Blind and Visually Impaired during the practice run. OneCourt was recently named to the latest cohort of the NBA Launchpad Incubation Program. The Washington-based startup first piloted with the Blazers in 2024, pivoting that experience to ongoing 2025 traction. You're listening to the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. And now, from the New York Times, when natural disasters hit, people with disabilities often feel them first and worst. Having a plan in case you need to evacuate or lose power is essential. Here's How to Make One by Sharon Schindel, published April 21st, 2025. As 75-mile-an-hour winds whipped black smoke across the sky, I stood in my kitchen, worrying about what it would take to evacuate. My husband had packed up the medications, arm and knee braces, and heating pads I needed to manage my debilitating chronic pain. But now what? It was January 8th in Los Angeles. There were 100,000 people under evacuation orders, and every hotel and Airbnb was booked. I had nowhere to go, no refills remaining on one of my medications, and no idea how bad my pain would become if I missed a scheduled medical procedure. Fires, floods, hurricanes, and other natural disasters are hitting harder than ever, and when they do, people with disabilities often feel the impact first and worst, said June Isaacson Kales, a disability policy consultant in Los Angeles. An estimated 1.3 billion people, or 16% of the world's population, has experienced significant disability. Despite facing a higher risk of injury or death than those without disabilities, however, 84% of people with disabilities worldwide report feeling unprepared. Your survival depends on having a plan and knowing how to carry out that plan, said Mike Deal, an amputee and former firefighter in Middletown, Ohio. Here's how to make one. Ask for help ahead of time. Start by knocking on your neighbor's door and talking about what you can do together in an emergency, suggested Germaine Perotti, an executive director of the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies, a nonprofit organization. In many cases, it is neighbors, not emergency workers, who carry out rescues, explained Mr. Perotti, who is quadriplegic and worked in Puerto Rico to assist people with disabilities who were affected by Hurricane Maria in 2017. Allison Freeman, a clinical psychologist who is deaf, learned after the LA wildfires that her apartment building issued announcements about emergencies only via loudspeaker, and that building staff members would not be permitted to leave the first floor and alert her in person during an evacuation. After that, she said, I took it upon myself to connect with other residents to see who would be willing to check in on me. Be proactive with your doctors, experts said. Ask for extra medication refills so that you have an emergency supply on hand and discuss how to manage possible treatment disruptions. If you depend on electricity, whether for a powered scooter, oxygen, or refrigerated medications, contact your power company before disaster strikes. They may be able to put you on a priority restoration list. Plan where you'll go. Tyler Lima Roop, who is 27 and lives in Los Angeles, relies on his power wheelchair and other medical devices to live and function. As wildfires threatened nearby neighborhoods earlier this year, he worried about finding a place that could support his extensive needs, including specialized equipment to help him move from his bed to a wheelchair or shower chair. Having to go somewhere at the drop of a dime is really hard for someone in my situation, Mr. Lima Roop said. Experts suggested creating a list of possible places to evacuate that you know can accommodate your needs, and keeping the necessary contact information on hand. If you need accessible transportation, arrange this ahead of time with someone you know, or with a disability resource agency in your area. This is essential, experts say, because emergency rescue teams are stretched thin during disasters. And know when you'll leave. Search online for your city or county emergency alert system and sign up for it. Opt in to receive wireless emergency alerts and consider downloading apps from the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the American Red Cross, which work with screen readers and flash notifications for those with vision or hearing impairments. Weather radios from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration can also send alerts using tone, lights, vibrations, or text displays. If your disability affects how quickly or safely you can evacuate, consider leaving before an order is issued. Because Mr. Dial knows that gathering and loading his supplies into the car could take precious time in an emergency, he keeps them ready to go. I'm prepared to get myself out of a bad situation before it becomes so dire that I need a rescue, Mr. Dial said. Evacuating early may also be a good idea if you depend on medical devices that require electricity and power outages seem likely, said Elizabeth Bubel, a program manager at the American Red Cross. Do not wait until disaster is at your door to test your exit route. For tornado preparations, for example, practice how quickly you can reach your home's lowest innermost room. If you have mobility limitations and work or live in a multi-story building, rehearse using evacuation chairs with those who would help you in an emergency. Prepare a go bag. Experts recommend using disability-specific checklists to build emergency kits for your home, work, and car. If some of your daily essentials cannot be stowed in a bag ahead of time, pack what you can and make a list of what you'll need to grab in the moment, said Ms. Kales, the disability policy consultant, and set yourself a semi-annual reminder to make sure your backup medications are not expired. Experts also suggested creating a photo album or log on your smartphone, listing any prescriptions or medical equipment in case they have to be left behind when you evacuate and later replaced. After evacuating, I was lucky to return to a home that was still standing. I began unpacking the bag I had scrambled to fill and then stopped. I left a few days' worth of clothes and medications and instant cold packs inside for the next time I might need them. This next piece comes from ABC News. The title, RFK Jr.'s Comments on Autism Draw Reactions from Parents and Experts. Parents and advocates say his recent comments were misguided, by Bethany Braun Silva. Published April 17, 2025. Parents of children with autism are speaking out against recent comments made by Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., saying his remarks about autism and vaccines reinforce harmful stereotypes and ignore the diversity and potential of people on the autism spectrum. He's spreading fear and misinformation, said Beth Hoffman, a Maryland-based mom of a 10-year-old non-speaking son with autism. Hoffman said she was outraged and disturbed, adding that Kennedy's comments about autism being an epidemic and a chronic disease causes falsehoods and a negative stigma. I'm sad for our country, my son's future, and everyone with a disability, she said. The backlash follows a new CDC report showing that autism diagnoses are on the rise, affecting 1 in 31 8-year-olds in the U.S. in 2022. On the heels of the report, Kennedy on Wednesday announced a directive to the National Institutes of Health to investigate what he called environmental exposures that he claimed could be contributing to that rise in diagnoses. Medical professionals say the rise in autism diagnosis is largely because of better awareness and diagnosis, as well as broadening medical definitions that now encompass a wider range of people on the autism spectrum. Kennedy pushed back on the idea that the surge in diagnosis may be due to increased awareness or better diagnostic tools, calling that explanation indefensible. Autism destroys families, and more important, it destroys our greatest resource, which is our children, he said at an HHS press conference in Washington, D.C. Autism advocates were dismayed to hear Kennedy's blanket characterization of children with autism. They'll never pay taxes, they'll never hold a job, they'll never play baseball, they'll never write a poem, they'll never go out on a date. Many of them will never use a toilet unassisted. Autism spectrum disorder, ASD, is a spectrum, which means symptoms vary by person. Some need little support in their daily lives, and some may need a great deal of support in performing day-to-day activities. Some may have advanced conversation skills, and others may be nonverbal. The new CDC report, for example, estimated that fewer than 40% of children diagnosed with autism in 2022 were classified as having an intellectual disability. Parents speak out. Actress and longtime autism advocate Holly Robinson Pete responded to Kennedy's comments on Wednesday with a pointed video on Instagram. "There is so much to unpack," she said in the video. "Autism is not a disease, it's a developmental disorder, and it is important to get that right." Pete, who has spoken extensively in the past about her son RJ's autism diagnosis 25 years ago, noted that he has checked off and shattered a lot of never off that list. Samantha Taylor, whose 20-year-old son is also on the spectrum, echoed that frustration. "Unless you are a parent of a child with autism, you can't begin to imagine what the journey is like," she told GMA. "To say that it's an epidemic and destroying families is an insult to everyone in the autism community." Taylor also shared additional thoughts in a Facebook post earlier Thursday, writing, "Autism doesn't destroy families. You know what does? Inaccurate information passed along as science." Alexis and Richard Brown, parents to 15-year-old twin boys with autism, told GMA they were disheartened by Kennedy's statements. "RFK had a lot of nerve stating that autism is ruining our lives," Alexis Brown said. Alexis Brown, who has served on the board of the Gentry Foundation for Autism since 2016, added, "Autism is a very broad spectrum, and it is not an epidemic. Our children play sports, are members of the National Junior Honor Society, serve as junior instructors in their jiu-jitsu black belt club, and do CrossFit. So let's debunk the idea that all children with autism will never use the toilet, never hold a job, or never succeed in life." Experts call for more research. Experts in the field echoed many of the concerns voiced by parents. "We are excited about Secretary Kennedy's interest in autism," said Tom Frazier, professor of psychology at John Carroll University and board chair at Autism Speaks, a nonprofit autism awareness organization. "But we have to make sure the research is focused on the needs of autistic people and their families, and that we're not recreating research that's already been done." Frazier pushed back on the sweeping generalizations shared by Kennedy, noting the wide range of abilities across the autism spectrum. Frazier, whose son is on the spectrum, said, "My son will probably never go on a date, but there are other autistic people who are incredibly socially successful and are an unbelievable asset to the world. It's a spectrum, and I think Kennedy may have been speaking for a subset of individuals, like my son, but his remarks were inelegant and didn't reflect the diversity of autistic experiences." He also emphasized the importance of collective progress. "Autism is underfunded relative to less prevalent conditions, and with 3.2% of children identified with autism, we need more support, more acceptance, and the right kind of research." Christopher Banks, President and CEO of the Autism Society of America, a national charitable organization dedicated to improving the lives of individuals on the autism spectrum, also weighed in, urging public leaders to ground their messaging in current science and respect for the community. The report cites that the rise in autism prevalence from 1 in 36 in 2020 to 1 in 31 in 2022 may reflect progress in awareness, increased access to screening and diagnosis, and also reinforces the urgent need for robust science-based research to better understand autism, Banks told GMA. Autism is a lifelong developmental disability that affects people of all backgrounds. Claims that autism is preventable or definitively caused by environmental toxins are not supported by current research. Banks also cautioned against framing autism through a lens of tragedy or fear and emphasized the importance of preserving access to essential programs. More inclusive systems, such as strong Medicaid coverage, lead to earlier identification and access to services, he said. This data makes clear the need for universal screening, trained pediatric providers, and equitable care. Next, another piece from Disability Scoop entitled IKEA Launches Collection of Accessible Products by Sean Heasley, published April 9, 2025. A major home furnishings retailer is introducing a new line of products designed to make life easier for people with disabilities. IKEA said this month that it is rolling out a collection of accessible items for the home. The line, known as Besingen, includes a shower chair, two different step stools, and a handful of bathroom accessories. There are many people who experience impactful and common circumstantial changes that can make something as simple as taking a shower challenging, said Wat Zijstra, a product design developer at IKEA. The starting point for Besingen was a clear need for specific product functions. Then, we widened our scope through design to ensure the products are for the many, as Besingen is created to support anyone in their daily life. Items in the inclusively designed collection are sturdy, easy to grip, and they feature soft edges, non-slippery feet, and holes for drainage, IKEA said. In addition, the products are offered in a dark color that was selected both to ensure that they are aesthetically pleasing and highly visible. The products were created to bring great functionality together with a beautiful design, as they have a minimalistic expression that is rooted in our Scandinavian design tradition. Besingen should blend in regardless of your style and shouldn't be something you need to put away or hide, said Sarah Fager, a senior designer at IKEA. Besingen is available in stores and online, with items ranging in price from $11.99 to $38.99. And now an opinion piece from the Charlotte Observer entitled, Disability is Inevitable. I Use Mine to Foster Better Understanding, by Gabby Morial. Published April 20th, 2025. Updated April 21st, 2025. For a long time, my disability was like my annoying little cousin. I was born with severe hearing loss and have worn hearing aids since I was 4 months old. I've had to take my disability everywhere with me, and for a long time, it was something that I just had to take care of in order to succeed in school. I felt neutral about my disability, never thinking much about whether it impacted my life at all, so it sat, dormant and small, for years. Then I got to Davidson College. My junior year, I took a class called Disability in Literature and Art, and I really understood disability for the first time. I was enthralled with the idea of disability as an intellectual and academic force, something that, when applied to art and literature, radically changed the shape and color of the work. What happens to our idea of beauty when we think of Venus de Milo not as just an armless statue, but as a double amputee, as depicted by René Magritte's Les Menots du Cuivre? When we emphasize that King Richard III in the titular Shakespeare play had scoliosis, how does that change our interpretations of the character's perception of himself and his motivations? I wrote my senior thesis using this method on two of Davidson's public art sculptures that depict human figures. What happens to the perception of these sculptures' presence on campus when we label these figures as explicitly disabled? This class made me then reflect on my own life, and I realized how my disability has impacted the way I socialized, my thought processes, and my core values. I remembered my frustrations in high school during rapid-fire conversations with friends, how I had to take extra time to process what they said. By the time I could formulate a characteristically me response, the conversation had already moved on. It's like being in another country and only knowing basic words in the native language. Your vocabulary is proficient enough where you can say basic things and ask necessary questions, but not broad enough to express the depth of your personality and who you really are. I thought about my thought process, how I can entertain myself for hours and create full, crystal-clear worlds in my head because I can take my hearing aids out and quite literally mute everything else around me and only focus on my inner monologue. The life I had lived thus far was rolling out in front of me, unmistakably and undeniably submerged in disability. After taking this class, I felt more three-dimensional than ever. I quickly realized that my disability was the thing that led me to Davidson. My disability created the conditions to foster my curiosity, my discipline, and my desire to connect with others through intentional and thoughtful interactions, which is exactly the kind of culture that Davidson College seeks to foster. I wanted other disabled students to experience this kind of epiphany about their own disabilities, so I dedicated my time to disability advocacy for the remainder of my Davidson career. Davidson saw the work I was doing and decided to create a fellowship that institutionalized this disability advocacy work. In my role, I'm able to create events and initiatives that educate and bring disabled and non-disabled people together to encourage an understanding of disability that goes beyond pain, suffering, and challenge. I have the freedom to create a history of disability at Davidson that is not about curing a disease or eliminating a disability, but is a purposeful celebration and acknowledgement of the lives, contributions, and legacies of Davidson's disabled community members. Everyone will become a part of the disability community eventually. With my work at Davidson, I want to ensure that phrase does not instill fear or anxiety in people, but confidence and reassurance so they can navigate and better understand the experience when their time comes. Now, I view my disability as a companion in my life, walking side by side with me everywhere I go. A phrase runs through my head all the time now. Disabled people deserve to be more than space and time. They deserve to be more than a body in an accommodations office or a name hidden in a medical form. Their disabilities should be an essential ingredient to making their lives three-dimensional and full and interesting, not just a body waiting for medical care. At Davidson, I get to make disability be something more than space and time. Gabby Moriel is from Washington, D.C. and lives in North Carolina. She majored in communication studies at Davidson College and works as an academic coach, event planner, and educator on disability justice. Well, that concludes our program. Thanks for tuning in to the Disability News Program here on SunSounds. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader, inviting you to join us again next time and to keep listening to SunSounds of Arizona.